This program is provided by lawyer Kyungjin Kim.
You know, usually when you talk about building the future, there's this underlying assumption that everyone is basically working with the exact same materials.
Right, yeah, like a shared foundation.
Exactly. I mean, if you're building a skyscraper, whether you're in New York or Shanghai, you buy the steel, you pour the concrete, and the building goes up.
Because, physics doesn't really care about borders. And historically, supply chains were just universal. That shared reality is kind of what allowed for decades of globalized tech growth. We all agreed on the basic rules of gravity, so to speak.
But then you step into the world of artificial intelligence and, global tech in June 2026, and suddenly half the world is building with completely different materials.
Yeah, the blueprints have completely changed.
Right. We're looking at a global landscape that is just bifurcating right before our eyes.
Welcome to another deep dive. Today, our mission is to explore this massive, incredibly dense stack of sources.
It's a comprehensive tech, robotics, and geopolitical briefing dated June 27, 2026. And we are looking at a snapshot of a world where the AI and hardware race is just moving at breakneck speed. The sources we're unpacking today cover everything from jaw-dropping AI software benchmarks to geopolitical supply chain chess, all the way down to physical humanoid robots playing soccer.
And this isn't just theoretical modeling anymore. I mean, the data in this briefing shows tangible physical shifts in how technology is produced, priced, and deployed on a global scale.
Which is exactly why you need to care about this, whether you're listening as a software developer or an investor managing a portfolio, or honestly, just someone trying to understand the future of the global economy.
Because those old rules of globalization, they are officially gone.
Yeah, they're history. Hmm. And this deep dive is your shortcut to understanding the new reality. So I want to dive right into the first major revelation in these sources. We're starting at the top of the tech stack.
Meaning the software and the models that users actually interact with.
Right, because the sheer scale of AI adoption happening right now, it just totally defies traditional logic.
We have to start with the software, because the numbers we're seeing here really set the stage for everything else. It's the demand engine.
Okay, let's unpack this. The briefing highlights ByteDance's recent launch of their Doubao 2.1 Pro model. And they're claiming that encoding and AI agent benchmarks, specifically things like Terminal Bench 2.1, SWE Pro, and Osworld, it is actually beating Claude Opus 4.6.
Which is a massive claim on its own.
It is, but what blows my mind isn't just the benchmark victory, it's the unimaginable volume. We are talking about over 180 trillion daily token calls.
What's fascinating here is how you ground that number. I mean, 180 trillion daily operations represents like a 1,500 times increase in just 2 years.
Wait, 1,500 times?
Yeah, in 2 years. A token is basically a chunk of a word or tiny piece of code that an AI processes. So processing 180 trillion of those every single day means this technology is no longer an experimental tool or some fun chatbot.
It's just infrastructure at this point.
Exactly. It's the underlying invisible infrastructure of daily digital life. Over 200 enterprises are calling more than a trillion tokens annually on this platform alone. They're integrating it into background apps, supply chain logistics, customer service, just everything.
And the pricing is where it gets completely wild. Doubao costs 6 RMB, which is Chinese yuan, per 1 million input tokens, and 30 RMB for output.
And if those tokens are cash, the price actually drops to 1.2 RMB.
Right. And the sources note that this total cost is roughly 80% lower than Claude Opus 4.6. Overall, Chinese AI token prices are sitting at about 1/6 of U.S. models.
Are we basically looking at the fast fashion of compute here?
Oh, that is a brilliant way to look at it. Think about the difference between a bespoke suit and fast fashion like Zara. A flagship U.S. model is like that bespoke suit, right? Highly capable, incredibly expensive, tailored for complex enterprise tasks.
And what's being built overseas is the Zara of AI. Precisely. It is incredibly cheap. It's quote unquote good enough for 90% of daily automated tasks. And because it costs pennies, developers are integrating it into absolutely everything.
Like your toaster, your car, your local grocery store inventory system.
Yeah, exactly. And by slashing those prices to an absolute fraction of US models, they're creating an economic moat based on pure, unavoidable volume.
Because the lower prices drive the massive token calls, right?
Right. And that massive volume, in turn, fuels the scale needed to drive the physical server infrastructure costs down even further. It's just an aggressive, self-sustaining adoption strategy that basically forces the technology to become ubiquitous.
And the corporate war chests backing this up are staggering. Like, the money is aggressively following this strategy. The briefing mentions DeepSeek is in the final stages of raising $7.4 billion.
Which values them at up to $59 billion. And that's with heavy backing from state AI funds, Tencent, and CATL.
And then you have Zippo AI, whose market cap just crossed 1 trillion Hong Kong dollars.
Yeah, and that Zippo AI valuation is a really critical indicator of how this bifurcation is actually leaking back into the U.S. market.
Wait, how so?
Well, their open source model, GLM 5.2, was released via MIT. And the sources note it is spreading rapidly within the U.S. developer community.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and this is happening concurrently with U.S. export bans on Anthropic's Fable model. So, ironically, American developers are picking up Zippo's open source model as a functional alternative because the domestic high-end option is restricted.
Okay, wait, pause for a second, because this brings up a massive contradiction in the sources. To run 180 trillion daily operations to support $59 billion startups, you need a literal mountain of computer chips.
A massive amount of hardware, yes.
But haven't U.S. sanctions practically blocked access to the best AI chips? How do you physically power this massive software scale when the front door to the hardware has been locked?
Yeah, that's the hardware paradox. You can't run 180 trillion tokens on sheer willpower or clever coding alone. It requires massive physical infrastructure, which takes us from the software layer straight down to the silicon layer.
And the sources have a very blunt take on this. There's a June 17 report from the Brookings Institution titled "Ball Game's Over."
Right. The U.S. is out of the AI chip market in China.
Yeah, and it concludes that the U.S. is completely out of the Chinese AI chip market with essentially zero prospect of return.
And the revenue numbers completely validate that title. Look at NVIDIA's H20 chip. That's a processor specifically designed to comply with earlier U.S. export limits.
Right, they made a ton of money on that initially.
They did. In 2024, NVIDIA made up to $15 billion in revenue in China with that chip. But then came a stricter block in April 2025.
And even though the U.S. later authorized sales of the slightly better H200s, the briefing explicitly notes that by May 2026, zero H200s have been sold to Chinese firms.
Not a single one.
Because Beijing directed their domestic companies to stop buying them and use domestic chips instead.
Exactly. And the Brookings Report's author, Mark McCarthy, outlines four main reasons for this permanent shift. First, they are successfully building domestic alternatives.
Okay.
Second, there are reliability concerns. Because nobody wants to build a multi-billion-dollar data center around a supplier that might get blocked next Tuesday by a new sanction.
That makes sense.
Third is a pure ideological drive for technological independence. And fourth is a strategic pivot toward AI diffusion.
Which is spreading the tech everywhere, like we talked about with the fast fashion analogy, rather than just chasing the singular smartest frontier model.
Right. And those domestic alternatives are not hypothetical prototypes anymore. The briefing cites a rigorous teardown by Tech Insights of the Huawei Kirin 9030 processor.
And that's the chip currently sitting inside the commercial Mate 80 Pro Max smartphone, right?
Yes. And Tech Insights confirmed it uses SMIC's N plus 3 process, which is a 5-nanometer chip.
Okay, I have to admit, I'm confused here. Because I know the multi-million dollar tools the U.S. banned were those EUV machines, the extreme ultraviolet lithography ones.
Right, there's the most advanced machines on Earth.
So how do you physically carve a 5-nanometer chip where the transistors are literally the size of a few atoms using the older, unrestricted DUV machines? I thought that was basically against the laws of physics.
It is incredibly difficult, but obviously not impossible.
Yeah.
It involves a technique called multiple patterning.
Multiple patterning.
Yeah, think of it like trying to draw incredibly fine microscopic lines with a marker that is slightly too thick. With the advanced EUV machines, you can just draw the perfect thin line in one single pass.
Okay.
But with the older DUV machines, you have to draw, shift the silicon wafer slightly, draw again, and repeat this process three or four times to etch that exact same microscopic 5-nanometer pattern.
So they're literally just brute forcing the manufacturing process.
Exactly. Now, the sources say this comes with a massive penalty. There is a 40% to 50% cost premium over using TSMC in Taiwan, and the capacity is incredibly low.
Like how low?
Only about 10,000 wafers a month. A lot of the silicon just gets ruined in that multi-pass process. But the ultimate point is, it works. They have proven they can manufacture a 5-nanometer chip entirely outside the U.S. ecosystem.
Here's where it gets really interesting. It feels like pruning a plant. You try to cut off the top branches to stop it from growing, but the plant's survival instinct kicks in.
It adapts.
Right. It just forces the roots to grow deeper, and eventually it branches out entirely on its own, completely separate from the original stem you were trying to control.
The profound irony here is that the export controls, designed to slow down the ecosystem, actually acted as the ultimate catalyst for complete self-reliance. I mean, yes, ESMIC is paying a massive cost premium. Yes, the yields are terrible without EUV lithography.
But they're willing to absorb that financial pain in exchange for sovereign independence.
Exactly. DeepSeek is already optimizing its billion-dollar software models specifically to run on Huawei's domestic Ascend chips. And Huawei's logic folding architecture is actually projected to reach TSMC 1.4 nanometer parity by 2031.
And TrendForce reports China aims to increase its 7-nanometer and 5-nanometer production fivefold in the next 2 years. Plus, the briefing points out China produces more than twice the electricity of the U.S.
Which is a crucial detail.
Right. So even if their chips are way less efficient, they have this massive brute force domestic energy grid to power this alternative hardware ecosystem.
They're basically offsetting the hardware constraint with massive energy output.
Yeah.
But if you are listening to this and wondering how the U.S. and its allies are responding, be assured this hardware independence isn't happening in a vacuum.
No, definitely not.
The realization that border bans on chips aren't enough has prompted a massive shift in global geopolitical strategy.
Because if you can't stop the hardware at the border, you try to ring fence the entire global supply chain. Which brings us to the June 25th Washington summit for an initiative called Pax Silica.
Yeah, and this represents the total institutionalization of the tech war. Pax Silica is a U.S.-led alliance attempting to cover the entire AI supply chain.
So we are talking about everything from mining the raw critical minerals to manufacturing the silicon, all the way up to software standards and logistics.
Exactly. It started as a smaller coalition in late 2025 with founding members like South Korea, Japan, the U.K., and Israel. Then India joined.
And as of this June 2026 summit, the EU, Germany, Greece, and the Netherlands have officially signed on, swelling the alliance to an incredible 30 countries.
Now, we need to pause and be very clear here. We are strictly, impartially reporting the contents and viewpoints presented in the sources provided. We aren't taking a side.
Yes, absolutely.
The briefing notes that Pax Silica is technically a non-binding agreement, but it is effectively attempting to form a massive, unified tech bloc. And the source material includes very conflicting global perspectives on this.
Right. To be totally clear, we are just conveying the viewpoints directly from the text. For instance, the briefing notes that the Global Times characterized the EU's entry into Pax Silica as, quote, undermining strategic autonomy.
And it also points out that France had previously labeled the initiative as colonization.
Those are the direct quotes from the source material, which really just highlights how politically explosive this supply chain reorganization has become on the world stage.
This raises an important question, though, because the diplomatic tension behind closed doors is very real. A report from the Center for Strategic and International Studies, that CSIS, analyzed the legal frameworks of these 30 allied nations.
And what did they find?
They pointed out that while Japan and the Netherlands have tightly aligned their export controls with Washington, countries like South Korea and Germany do not currently have U.S.-style comprehensive export controls on their books.
But hold on, let me just put myself in the shoes of one of these middle players. Say I'm South Korea, I'm a founding member of Pax Silica, and my foundational security ally is essentially demanding I fall in line and stop selling tech to China.
Right, the pressure is immense.
But the briefing also says South Korean memory chip exports to China are currently up 243%. At a certain point, doesn't basic economics just beat geopolitical treaties? Like, how can Pax Silica actually enforce this?
That is the exact tension the CSIS report is highlighting. These middle nations are walking a razor-thin tightrope right now. You mentioned the Korean memory chips. Those are specifically HBM3 chips, or high-bandwidth memory.
And why are those specific chips so important? I know they're critical, but why?
Think of the GPU, like the Huawei Ascend chip, as an incredibly fast brain. But that brain is totally useless if you can't access data fast enough. HBM3 is the multi-lane hyperspeed highway that feeds the data into the GPU brain.
So if the memory highway is choked, the AI brain basically starves?
Exactly. And currently, South Korea completely dominates the production of these memory highways.
So South Korean companies are making an absolute fortune selling the memory that powers the alternative Chinese data centers.
Correct. And we are seeing a shift from simple export regulations to the attempted creation of absolute divided supply chain blocks. By publicly pointing out Korea and Germany's lack of aligned controls, the CSIS report is acting as a clear, undeniable signal of mounting pressure on those nations.
And here is the kicker for those Korean companies. The briefing notes that if China's domestic HBM3 memory production from internal companies like CXMT actually succeeds in scaling up, this massive Korean export boom might end anyway.
Yeah, they're getting squeezed from the geopolitical side and the market competition side simultaneously. If you're an investor listening to this, that dynamic is a massive variable for your portfolio. It's high-level geopolitical theory clashing directly with raw economic reality.
It is. But I want to bring this all back down to earth for a minute. We've spent the last few minutes talking about 180 trillion invisible software tokens, atomic-level 5-nanometer chips, and 30-nation supply chain treaties.
The abstract layers of the tech stack, basically.
Right. But what does this isolated, hyperscaled, brute force technology actually look like when it manifests in the physical world?
And this is the culmination of the deep dive. The software, the hardware, and the geopolitics are converging into physical, embodied technologies.
The AI is literally stepping out of the cooled server racks.
Exactly. Stepping right out into our physical space.
The sources cover the recent MWC Shanghai 2026 event. MWC stands for Mobile World Congress, which historically, you know, has always been a telecom and cell phone event.
Yeah, in the mobile industry.
And they had 37,300 attendees from 143 countries. But crucially, a full 33% of the attendees were from outside the traditional mobile industry.
Because the leadership of the GSMA, the organization that actually runs the event, explicitly acknowledged this massive pivot. The GSMA Secretary General declared that the mobile industry has fundamentally shifted its mission.
They said the era of connecting people is over, right?
Yes. The new mission is supporting intelligent machines.
And the physical infrastructure is actively being laid down for it. The sources show 5GA, or advanced 5G, is now active in 330 Chinese cities. ZTE was there showing off their SuperPod AI infrastructure.
Oh, the liquid-cooled beast.
Yeah, a liquid-cooled beast that can scale up to 16,000 GPUs in a single rack system. But the absolute wildest part of LWC wasn't the telecom servers, it was the MWC humanoid penalty shootout.
This is where those abstract concepts we've discussed become completely undeniable. The briefing includes data from the Embodied AI Summit in Hangzhou, noting that China now holds 50% of the global humanoid robot market.
Half the global market.
Yeah. And the penalty shootout was just a chaotic physical showcase of that market dominance.
And it wasn't some highly polished, pre-rendered marketing video either. 8 different teams competed in over 100 rounds of actual physical penalty kicks.
It was messy.
So messy. But I love the narrative here because it highlights the reality of real-world physics. Look at the company that took third place, Jingxu. Their robot's frame was 30% lighter than the other.
Which sounds great on paper.
Right, but the sources say it was super bug prone and had intermittent errors because it was their very first time competing. Imagine a robot perfectly recognizing the ball, but its lightweight frame simply can't handle the physical recoil of a kick, so it just stumbles.
It was a true stress test. And the rules of the game are what make this profound. Absolutely no remote controls and no pre-programming the kick sequence.
Zero human intervention.
None. These machines had to visually recognize the ball, calculate the physics, position their mass, shoot, and defend entirely on their own processing power.
Which is why the company Tianxu Tanjie took second place. Their robot had superior servo control and dynamic balance to actually handle the physical world. But first place went to China Mobile.
Yeah, and their approach was brilliant.
Their robot won by utilizing low-latency 5G connected to edge AI computing.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it ties the entire deep dive together perfectly. Think about it. Those 180 trillion cheap software tokens from Section 1, the massive EUV-less Huawei server hardware from Section 2, the advanced 5G networks.
They're all merging together.
Yes. They're all acting as the offboard brain and the nervous system for these physical machines.
It reminds me of the early days of dial-up internet, or like the very first autonomous cars bumping into traffic cones. It's raw, it's unscripted, and it's messy. We are literally watching the real-time birth of a new physical species.
And they are commercializing way faster than anyone predicted. The briefing actually covers the launch of the UBTech U1. This is a consumer humanoid robot launching on June 30th.
A consumer model.
Yes. It comes in a male model at 183 centimeters and a female model at 168 centimeters. It has silicone skin, 88 degrees of freedom in its movement, and it cost about $30,000.
$30,000. I mean, that is just the price of a mid-range sedan. And before it even officially launched, they already had 5,000 pre-orders placed with over $1 million in deposits. Just think about the social impact of 5,000 silicone-skin humanoids walking into homes and businesses.
And to show you just how fast this is hitting society, the regulatory reality is just scrambling to catch up. The sources mention new rules from the CAC taking effect on July 15th.
What kind of rules?
Authorities are already implementing strict regulations, like explicitly banning AI virtual lover services for minors and mandating very clear labeling for any anthropomorphic AI.
The technology is moving so fast that the government is having to proactively manage human-AI social interactions before the robots even ship.
It is just a staggering amount of change to process. I mean, we started this deep dive looking at dirt cheap, hyperscale software, you know, the fast fashion of compute.
Right.
We unpacked how the block on high-end chips didn't stop the growth. It just forced the brute force creation of 5-nanometer domestic silicon. We watched the global response of building the 30-nation pack silica block to ring-fence the supply chain.
The institutionalization of the tech war.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And all of it culminated in autonomous edge computing humanoids playing soccer and taking thousands of consumer pre-orders. Understanding these underlying mechanisms is so crucial for you, the listener, because these aren't just isolated tech updates in some newsletter. They are actively rewriting the global economy, your investments, and the actual physical world around us.
And I want to leave you with one final thought to ponder, building off everything we just unpacked today.
Let's hear it.
If PAX Silica actually succeeds in its mission of splitting the world into two completely separate ring-fenced tech ecosystems, each with their own software models, their own silicon architectures, and their own robotic hardware, what happens in 10 or 20 years when these two completely alien technological trees finally have to interact with one another?
Oh, man, that is a wild thought to leave on. Two totally different species of technology meeting for the very first time. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the information around you, and we'll catch you on the next one.
This program is provided by Lawyer Kyungjin Kim.